for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Not too long ago, letter writing was our only means of bridging distance. Communications from separated lovers, soldiers afar, even leaders of countries were relegated to pen and paper. In a new book, novelist and literary critic Tom Mallon offers a non-nostalgic and wide-ranging look back at some of the many collections of letters saved from years past. His book is titled Yours Ever. Tom Mallon joins me in the studio to talk about the people and their letters as we move ever so steadily into the digital age. And, of course, we invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to send us a tweet or join us through Facebook. Tom Mallon, it's good to see you.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
You know, as soon as I started reading your book, I thought back to the age of 16 when I was receiving letters from a beloved boyfriend who was at Georgia Tech. And I knew his handwriting, and I was so excited to receive those letters and couldn't wait for the mailman to get there. And I thought, there's not that happening much anymore.
No, it's I don't think the letter will die out, but it is becoming more of a special occasion thing. There are certain instances that seem to call for it. Most people with a sympathy letter, for instance, they won't. Although I was horrified a couple of months ago to realize that a friend of mine, his sister had died, and I actually sent what I didn't realize until after I sent it was a sympathy email, and I thought one can't do that. That really is the end of civilization.
It doesn't have the same impact, does it? It really doesn't. You say it really embarrasses you to admit you began writing this book when a first-class stamp cost 29 cents, and you've just finished it.
That's true. I started, this book was signed up in 1994, and I originally thought it would come out around 96, 97, and I had a very patient, indulgent editor, and he I'd write a chapter of it, and then I'd go off and write another novel, and then I'd write another chapter. And so it was never totally dead, but it accumulated very slowly. But it sounded like rationalization at first, but we both came to believe that it was probably a lucky break, actually, that it came out so much later. Because if it had come out in 96, 97, I don't think I would have seen this through the prism of email. Email was just sort of trickling down to everybody. And I think that in the dozen years that have just passed, I began to see all of this material through the way we communicate now. And I think it probably added a dimension to the book.
And cell phones as well. I mean, the cell phone, the email, the tweet, whatever is moving in there so quickly.
I had written a book about diaries 25 years ago. This was always meant to be the companion volume. And I had said something in the preface of that book that I remember a lot of reviewers and radio hosts and so forth took exception to. I had said that no one ever kept a diary just for himself. And they would say, oh, but surely the appeal is secrecy and so forth. And I thought, no, everybody always wants an audience eventually, even if it's posthumous. And I thought that there was this act of display in a diary. And I think actually blogging and tweeting have kind of confirmed my position on this, in that they're sort of public diaries. You know, if you put out a blog, you say what you're doing, a tweet, it's like a mini diary entry, and, you know, it's public to everybody. And it's sort of like we've gone from the unexamined life not being worth living to the unbroadcast life not being worth living.
Were you always a letter writer?
I think so. I went away to college, 40 years ago, and you would make that weekly collect phone call from the one payphone down the hall. And so letters were 6 cents. I still have most of the letters from my father, which I've saved and were very important to me, came from that time. And Franklin Roosevelt's face is on the 6 cent stamp in 1969. And I wrote a lot of letters from college, and most of my friends did. I'm not quite sure. I guess it was email that put an end to that practice. But it seems to me that I wrote letters all the time. I certainly got them all the time.
Well, and we didn't make long-distance phone calls with, we were so careful about spending the money on long-distance calls.
And, you never really thought, you saved letters sort of automatically, mm-hmm. but you never really thought of, archiving them and being very conscious of that. But you did save them, and they're still there. I still have them. Whereas with email, I tried, like most people, to develop a system for what I would save and what I would get rid of and how I would keep it, what I would print, what I would do. And in the end, it breaks down. And I think people archive very little of their email.
Why do you suppose you got started on this book?
Well, it had always appealed to me. My novels have been about often minor characters in history, people on the fringes of things. And my literary criticism has often been about these oddball genres and subjects, diaries, plagiarism, not really a genre, but a subject. And one of the things that interested me about diaries was the same as letters, how often it was a natural genre for so many people. There were people who really excelled in it, just the way there are great storytellers, there are great letter writers, and the form comes naturally to some people. And there were some people who, for one reason or another, couldn't live literary lives as we think of them, who managed to flourish in this kind of unpublished way. I mean, like diaries, letters were a tremendous vehicle for women in the 17th, 18th, 19th mm-hmm. centuries, when careers as writers might not have been as available to them. And this became a medium of expression for them. So as a literature, it interested me.
And you're hearing the voice of Tom Mallon. He has a new book out. It is all about letters and the people who write them. It has on its cover a brown envelope, an airmail envelope, and then a signature, yours ever. I'm sure there are many of you who have written letters and continue to write letters. A dear friend of mine writes a single letter every single day to her son, who is emotionally handicapped and lives in another state. She writes him every single day. Isn't that marvelous?
And somehow it's not it's the same to send an email every day.
Of course
It's not that writing letters is so difficult, but there is this effort that comes with it, and the tangibility and an intimacy. Because I think one of the things about email is that no one ever feels that it's truly private the way a letter is. You can leave a letter on the counter and somebody can discover it, but the way in which email is forwarded instantly. I'm aghast at some of the emails people forward to me. FYI, and it, clearly the writer didn't want this sent beyond the recipient, but it happens all the time. And I think when you become conscious of that, you don't write with the same degree of intimacy.
You feel that we can learn at least as much, if not more, from letters than we can from biographies.
Well, you sort of eliminate the middleman with letters. Biographers can be wonderful interpreters of things. But, when I talk to people who want to write historical fiction, which is sort of my bailiwick, I always tell them, read less about the period, read more from the period, if you really want to know how people think, how they spoke, how they wrote. And it's the same, I think, with letters. You take away that filter, and there's this tremendous immediacy to them. And if you're doing research into somebody and reading their letters, to read the actual, if you have the opportunity to read the actual pieces of paper and not a published edition of them, it can be an extraordinary experience.
So what do you think makes for a good letter?
I think performance, a consciousness upon in the writer that this is going to some person, and that you're obligated to entertain them and to turn a phrase, to tell a story with a certain shape to it, and to be conversational and so forth. There's a kind of composition to them. I do have a few friends who write emails in the same way they used to write letters. Patricia Hampel's a wonderful writer, a memoirist.
And, she is, indeed.
And Trish, still, when I get an email from her, it's a moment of excitement because I know that it's basically going to be a letter. She still writes them with the same kind of length and shapeliness and performance to them. And I think that that's always made a good letter.
So as a writer, you are clearly very interested in shape and form, and not just the message, which is what a lot of emails are about.
I think that's true. Emails are really all business, even when they seem to be very personal.
Tom Allen, his new book is titled Yours Ever, People and Their Letters. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your tweets, your messages from Facebook, and your email. And here, Tom Mellon, is a message from Facebook. Lauren says, I'm in my 20s, but my romance with my husband began with letters. He was stationed in Iraq at the beginning of the war, and I wrote to him as a kind gesture. The sides of him that came through those letters made me fall in love with a man who up until then had just been a friend. We still write letters to each other in a special journal. Some things are said best with a pen. Isn't that beautiful?
It's wonderful. And I do think there are people who come alive in a way in a letter, the same way they do in a diary, because they have this sense of calm, sense of quiet. One of the things about email, and it's the downside of its convenience, is that we write it too hastily, and we often regret what we've said. But the thoughtfulness of a letter, I think, allows you to tap into precincts of yourself that you may not be able to on the computer.
And one of the people whose letters you look at is Woodrow Wilson. Talk about some of the letters he wrote.
Well, I liked collections of letters that surprised me. And, you know, if you think of our image of Woodrow Wilson, the professor, literally the professor, very severe, thin, morally serious, trying to remap the world and spread democracy and so forth, we don't think of him as a lover. But in fact, there's a volume of his love letters which just fascinated me. He became a widower while he was in the White House. His first wife, Ellen, whom he had written to court, and they continued to exchange letters through their marriage. She died during his first term, and his physician and one of his younger relatives fixed him up with Mrs. Edith Galt, who was the widow of a Washington jeweler. Galt was right here in town until a few years ago, and she was this very plump, vivacious person, and they wanted to bring Wilson out of his widower's funk, and it took to an extent they never expected. And they had this kind of whirlwind 6-month epistolary courtship just across town exchanging letters. And they married, as I said, within 6 months. But the side of Wilson that comes out in those letters is completely unexpected, or was to me. And this is my commentary on a bit of them. Edith Galt was a less cerebral companion than Ellen had been. In one décolleté portrait, this juicy corporeal presence looks like Madame X as seen through the eyes of Botero. And it's not hard to imagine how Wilson, who once said he was carrying a volcano inside, felt ready to blow. Quote, "If ever again I have to be with you for an hour and a half," he writes her on June 5th, "with only 2 stolen glances to express my all but irresistible desire to take you in my arms and smother you with kisses, I am sure I shall crack an artery." 2 weeks later, while Edith has tea at the White House with Helen Bones, Wilson's relative, Wilson hides behind some lace curtains in the green room, writing afterward that he, quote, "feasted his eyes on the loveliest person in the world with, oh, such a longing to go to her and take her in my arms and cover her with kisses," unquote. He more than once talks about his competing personalities, the boy that is in me and who has found a perfect playmate, the lover in me who has found love like his own, the man of affairs. And in a summer of war fevers, he turns Edith's love for him into her patriotic duty. Quote, "I am absolutely dependent on intimate love for the right and free and most effective use of my powers. What it costs my work to do without it."
Wow.
So there's a certain emotional blackmail there.
He really is.
Do this for your country.
Yeah, exactly. Do this for your country. That must have been such fun for you to find.
It was, and it really does change your image of him. And, of course, one of the paradoxes with letters between lovers is that despite the lovely communication you got from the woman that you just read, in most instances, when the lovers are united, when the distance is overcome, the letters stop. And that's true with the Wilsons. He and his first wife wrote to each other during their marriage when he would be away for even a day at a time. But the letters really stop with the wedding of between him and Mrs. Galt.
And yet you have a chapter titled Absence.
Absence, which is really, I think, the main motivation for letters, the way they sprang up. Distance has always been what letters were trying to defeat. And they were trying to bring people together, literally together. I mean, it is a piece of yourself. You leave your DNA on letters. The Unabomber was, in fact, one of the ways they confirmed his identity was there was DNA on the stamps that he had licked on the letters. It's literally a piece of yourself. You can enclose things and so forth. And so that was always the main reason for writing.
Here's another lovely email from Carrie, who's in Indianapolis. She says, "When visiting a friend during our first year of college in 1992, I met and fell madly in love with one of her new college classmates. He was in Michigan. I was in Massachusetts. We embarked on a furious letter-writing campaign that lasted for several years until we broke up. Through the following years, multiple moves, other boyfriends, I always kept the letters. Almost 10 years after we broke up, we reunited and are now happily married with a beautiful baby boy. I still have the letters, and I cherish them to this day.
I think that this sense of the transporting qualities of letters, the way they take you back. And one experience that's coming to my mind, I had a friend that I taught with many years ago at Vassar who died much too young a few years ago. And we were young colleagues together. We were both in our late 20s, overworked, unhappy, untenured. And I had a sabbatical 1 year. This was 82, 83, and I was in England. And she wrote me every week, old-fashioned style, onion skin paper, airmail envelopes, whatever. The letters were full of gossip about colleagues, complaints, whatever, all the things we had gone through. And they were really performances, and they were funny. And there was a side of her that, to me, in our friendship as the years went by, got lost. She had had a lot of setbacks, disappointments in life. And I began to forget this whole side of her, because in later years in our friendship, and we sort of drifted apart, I became preoccupied with a much more melancholy and much less fun side of her. And these letters, after she died, I read them, and they restored her to me in some ways that I don't think anything else could have done.
Isn't that lovely? My husband and I were at our farm in northeastern Pennsylvania a few years ago and happened on a very snowy, closed-in week to pull out letters that his father had written to his mother during World War II that my husband had never seen before. And we read them out loud to each other. By then, both my mother and father-in-law had died. It gave us a whole new picture, not only of them individually, but of their lives together.
Yeah. The relic aspect of them, too, the physicality of them, I think, is very much an appeal to me. I wrote an essay many years ago about my father's canceled checks. He died in 1980, and about a dozen years after that, I went through these shoe boxes of canceled checks that he had saved going back to the late 1940s.
Why?
I really don't know why. He wasn't going to get audited 30 years later.
Right.
But I think I sort of figured it out after, and I put them in order. It took me forever to organize them. And his whole adult life was there.
Exactly.
I found the check that was paid to the doctor who delivered me, you know, my first pair of glasses, all of these family milestones you could find. And I think that he intuited that they were kind of odd legacy.
You include some boring letters. The Duke of Windsor, for example. Tell me about the Duke of Windsor and why his letters were so boring.
He was just such a sap. People's love letters. I'm sure that Woodrow Wilson would cringe to think that posterity was reading some of these love letters. But and we often bring out a kind of infantile side of ourselves with terms of endearment and so forth. But to read his correspondence with Wallace Simpson, eventually the Duchess of Windsor, is to first get a sense of how shrewd she was. She must have had 40 IQ points on him. And just how babyish and silly he was. Desire to be protected, subordinated, and to talk with all these just silly, effusive expressions.
Almost infantile.
He can't think his way through anything, whereas she's sort of thinking of the situation two steps ahead and realizing what's going to have to be done and so forth. And they're incredibly uninspiring. And they sort of bring to mind, what England was spared by not having him on the throne during the Second World War.
We have lots of callers waiting. I do want to bring them into the conversation. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow at WAMU.org. First to Northwood, New Hampshire. Good morning, Barbara. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I listen to your show regularly.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
What I wanted to say was I'm fortunate enough to have my grandparents' courting letters, my parents' courting letters, and my husband and my courting letters.
Oh, how wonderful.
I'm 80 years old, and my grandparents' letters were written in the late 88. Of the last...
1888.
Yeah, 1888.
Right.
And my parents were written in the 20s, and ours, my husband's and mine, were written in the 40s. And there's such a social history, as well as such a indication of the people that they were. And I just feel very fortunate, as do my children.
You are indeed, Tom.
I think she's very lucky to have all that. And I have only one letter from my grandmother. I went away to college, as I think I mentioned, 1969. My grandmother was 93 at the time, and I was homesick, which was a shameful thing to admit in the 60s. But I actually missed being home. And my father asked my grandmother, who had very little schooling and so forth, to write me a letter. And she did. And it's the one thing I have
and
in her hand.
And you
saved it? Oh, sure.
How
I still
wonderful.
Have it. But the caller makes a wonderful point, too. It's often, and this is also true in diaries, letters often come alive when people stop talking about themselves and something about the news of the day, something that's going on. The caller was mentioning social texture, and they often have that dimension to them, this kind of documentary quality, and you learn a lot of history incidentally from them.
Thomas Mallon, his new book, All About People and Their Letters, is titled Yours Ever. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Wichita, Kansas. Good morning, Charlie. You're on the air.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I was going to comment on the fact that in the past I have written letters on specific subjects to things like the White House, the Pentagon, et cetera, et cetera. And there's that difference between striking a chord with them where you get not the boilerplate response, thank you very much for writing the White House, you know, but a personal response in regard to what you wrote about. And I treasure these letters and keep them in an old file cabinet that's been in the family for 60 years. And I have letters from Frank Capra and General Colin Powell, and you write to them, and you strike a nerve, but that the response comes back personally. General Powell wrote, I had called to congratulate, or written to congratulate him on finally establishing the memorial at Fort Leavenworth to the Buffalo Soldiers, and I happened to mention that one of my favorite historic characters was Lieutenant Henry Flipper, who was the first black graduate of West Point, and I got a personal reply.
How wonderful. That is certainly something to treasure, isn't it?
I have a letter that I got. I wrote to President Kennedy when I was, it's not a last from President Kennedy, but I wrote to the White House. In my Catholic childhood, we were all fired up about the decision not to allow prayer in school anymore. I've since changed my position on this, but in 1962, when the decision came down, I wrote to the White House saying that, you know, we should still be allowed to say this prayer in school. And I got a letter back from one of the president's assistants. I think his name was Ralph Duggan, who assured me that the president always liked hearing from boys and girls. And he included a little portion of the press conference transcript in which President Kennedy had commented on this. And I still have this letter with a 4 cents Project Mercury stamp on it. And I never felt taken so seriously in my life, I think, before or since. And it was sort of thrilling.
Did you get round to collecting stamps, given your interest in letter writing?
I did for a while. And you know what? I don't have the foggiest notion where that stamp album wound up. I thought about that not long ago. I did collect it for them for quite a while. And I've been very good at, like I said, keeping letters, but the stamp album is gone.
One of the people you talk about is Adams, you call him insufferable.
Jefferson.
I thought it was the other way around. I thought Jefferson was the one who wrote beautiful letters, but I gather it was the other way around.
Jefferson drove me a little bit crazy. The Adams letters, of course, are very interesting, the Abigail and John letters.
Of course, but, Abigail.
But Jefferson... There are a lot of presidents in the book. I think it's just because I like politics and live in Washington. And whereas Wilson surprised me in a happy way, Jefferson repelled me in some ways.
Why?
The bossiness, the darkness of the letters, the way in which he hectors and lectures his family, and there's... he's constantly laying down the law in his letters, very different from many other presidents.
Tom Mallon, his new book is titled Yours Ever. When we come back, more of your calls, your email, and your tweets. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Clint Eastwood, who directed the new film Invictus, and Morgan Freeman, who stars as Nelson Mandela.
This is no time to celebrate petty revenge. This is the time to build our nation. You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
Freeman and Eastwood on the next Fresh Air.
For those of you who've just joined us, Tom Mallon is with me. He has written numerous novels, but his latest book is titled Yours Ever, People and Their Letters. Let's go right back to the phones to Spring Lake, Michigan. Good morning, Kristen. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I recently spent 7 months teaching in France, and I became good friends with several of my coworkers. When I got home, I felt really cut off and really homesick, and I had written a letter to one of them. I didn't hear a response for about 2 months, but when I got that letter, I was overwhelmed with emotion, and I started reading it, and my friend just kept saying, your letter touched me so much. Your letter really, you know, made me miss you. And I wrote back, and it's been a couple months now, and I still haven't heard anything. But in my response to that letter, I a little bit dramatically said that I understand now how, like, the settlers must have felt when they came over from Europe and didn't have any news from their families for months and months. Then all of a sudden, they received a letter, and how incredibly emotional getting that physical letter can be.
Oh, boy, I should say, Tom.
I think waiting is one of the real pleasures of letter writing. It's a frustration while you're doing it.
Right.
But in retrospect, you realize, as with so many pleasures, the anticipation of it is very important. And not to keep whipping email, but email's taken that pleasure away, too. It's all too fast right now.
What about the letters of Mary McCarthy?
Mary McCarthy was a good friend of mine. I knew her at the end of her life and at sort of the beginning of my writing life. She was a thoroughly enchanting, awe-inspiring figure to me. And she had a reputation for being very witty, very severe. She was nothing but nice to me and somebody I wanted to live up to. And I cherish letters that I had from her. But the letters that I wrote about of hers in Yours Ever are the ones she exchanged with Hannah Arendt, the philosopher. And they were very good friends. And their correspondence, which we have both sides of, and that's an interesting thing, too. It's nice to have two sides of a correspondence.
Sure.
We don't often have that. But their correspondence runs the gamut. They write about serious intellectual matters, ideas, whatever, then lots of literary gossip, lots of personal revelation, whatever. And it's just this very full-bodied kind of stew, and they go from one thing to the other without any kind of dutiful sense of proportion that they impose. They just, whatever's on their mind.
What can you read for us?
This is a couple of paragraphs about their correspondence. What makes their letters so pleasurable, sometimes even thrilling, is a consistent mixture of the abstract and concrete, of world politics and personal foibles. Along with meditations on the nature of will and the problems of equality, one finds literary gossip. Quote, "This is the second mad girl Raymond Aron has been involved with. The first tried to commit suicide to embarrass him." Sharp dismissals. "Dame Rebecca West is a good talker and cracked. She imagines that various authors are alluding to her and all her relatives under disguises in their books." And quick character sketches that rise above comic specificity towards some larger insight. It's inevitable that most of the letters sparkle, including the quotations above, come from McCarthy. Her eye for misbehavior was unerringly avid, and linguistically she stood on native ground, though Arendt's malapropisms, ends and odds, have their charm. The greatest romantic drama of McCarthy's life comes at the beginning of the 1960s when she finds herself, quote, totally, entirely in love with the man who will become her fourth husband, the American diplomat James West. The complications are formidable. West's current wife seems ready to use their children as a weapon against him, while he and McCarthy, trying to secure divorces, conduct their affair behind the backs of West's State Department bosses and within earshot of the communist authorities in Warsaw, where he is posted. Quote, "We've come to look on my hideous hotel room with flowered bedspreads and curtains decorated with red stars and the listening device in the lighting fixture as a tenderly loved home and refuge, as though we were living a peculiar modern idyll, intense love in extreme conditions to be transcribed by the secret police."
Oh, my goodness. You know, my husband and I were in Moscow in the late 70s, and I remember looking up there at the light, wondering where that listening device was. Thinking about the season, Tom, what is your view of Christmas letters?
Well, you mean the enclosures and that are sent out to a group. They're, I think, compared to tweets, they're a relic of civilization in a way. I mean, at first, I can't remember when they caught on. It seems to me maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah, about that.
The Dear Everybody kind of letter.
Yeah.
That they seemed so impersonal in a way. But, you know, I do think there's something touching about them, the way in which they try to bring you up to date and give the whole year's narrative and so forth. And I suspect that they're becoming kind of quaint and maybe even obsolete, you know, in the age of email. But I like them. And frequently when you get them, you'll get it. And then there's something handwritten at the bottom. You know, a lot of people who send them, even if it's just one or two lines, they personalize them in some way. And to me, that's cheery.
I just finished my Christmas letter yesterday, so I'll pass it on to you at some point. Let's go now to Ridgefield, Connecticut. Good morning, Nathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. How's Tom?
Hi there.
So I just wanted to kind of interject a perspective for maybe a younger person. I'm in my 20s, and I run a company called Forgetful Gentlemen, and we offer products, services, and education that help make it easy for the modern man to remember key events in his life and then write and send handwritten correspondence for those events. And what we found is that it's not necessarily a lack of good intentions that's leading to the extinction of the written word. It's more, you know, that you know, after all, you know, everyone loves the idea of handwritten correspondence, right? But it's more that, you know, we have these obstacles that are introduced by our busy lives, and then we have these quick, easy, yet impersonal alternatives that technology has presented. So what we've tried to do with Forgetful Gentlemen is develop products that remove the obstacles and make sending a handwritten card or note almost as easy as, you know, the congratulatory.
Wait a minute. So what are you telling me? What you're doing is writing notes or composing notes for men who perhaps don't know how to do them?
We don't do it for them, but we provide them with a product that removes some of the obstacles that keep them from doing it.
Like what?
So, like, you know, first big obstacle for a lot of men is they just don't remember the event, so they miss their anniversary or
their mom's birthday
or whatever, right? So we provide with our cards, we provide an online personal kind of assistant calendar that's completely customizable. You can get reminders by text message and email. So
okay.
We kind of leverage the technology.
Help me to understand how this may somehow boost that person's interest in writing a personal note.
Right. Well, we're not trying to convert people who, you know, don't believe in the handwritten note. We've coined this term "forgetful gentleman," and what we refer to a forgetful gentleman as is someone who is classy, sophisticated, has interest in doing this, but whose busy modern life kind of gets in the way.
And for that person, maybe the tweet is what you need.
Right. I think one thing that is also keeping people from writing as many letters as they might like to today is the decline in people's handwriting skills.
Of course.
Because I noticed this. I hope my students aren't listening. When you have them take an exam, it's a struggle for them to handwrite in a blue book now because they don't do cursive. You'll collect 20 blue books.
Prints.
And, yeah, and
they print.
It's exhausting. They can't get as much down in a couple of hours. And I think that handwriting is not a real pleasure for a lot of people these days because they have a sense of just how out of practice they are.
So interesting. I've watched that print sort of habit grow and wondered exactly how it got started. Let's go to Vernon, New York. Good morning, Cynthia.
Hi, Diane, and hi, Tom. As an old school teacher, 80 years old, yeah, I just want to make this first point that, you know, the Palmer method handwriting, it's like, in order to know how to write, it's like playing the piano.
Yep.
You have to practice it, and it's sad that people write you a little thank you note. You could hardly read the thing. But I want my point in calling today, and thank you for taking my call. In my 80 years, letters have always been important to me from the V letters. Mm-hmm. My brother sent me to the Navy. I mean, from the Navy, World War II. And now in my hand, I have a copy of the most beautiful, non-confrontational, non-violent letter to our president from Mike Ferner, who is the president of Veterans for Peace. And I just want to share this with everyone because not just from the idea of how, I know that you'd be interested in reading it. Can I just give you the web page that of the address of their organization? I've also got the old snail mail address.
Yeah, just give me the web page, please.
Okay, it's VFP
uh-huh.
at veteransforpeace.net.
Right.
And I just treasure this letter.
Okay. I thank you for calling. We've got that VFP.net. Thanks for calling, Cynthia. Now to Wanda, who's in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
I'm enjoying your program.
I'm so glad.
I should mention my 20-year-old granddaughter now is in her third year in college. And, of course, we used email for a long time. And at the beginning of this year, she decided that we should not use email anymore, that we should write each other real long letters every week, and so that's what we do.
So your 19-year-old granddaughter is the one who suggested it.
Exactly. And I'm 86.
She knows that.
I treasure letters. I have a cedar chest full of old letters, and they live on long after you're gone.
Well, of course. Now, Wanda, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Are you computer savvy as well?
Oh, yes. Yes,
so you've been using the computer.
Oh, since whenever? Email, 90s?
Absolutely.
In the 90s.
That's mm-hmm. great. And what do you find is the difference between the letters you get from your granddaughter and perhaps the email you used to get from her?
I think they're more intimate. She talks about her friends. She talks about her classes, her teachers, her assignments, where they go out in the evening. They're usually just two pages long, but they're in longhand. She writes them out.
All right.
And I treasure them. And the one thing I should also mention, since I have collected letters for years, and I love old manuscript letters, the envelopes are extremely important. Don't throw the envelopes away. The stamps tell their story. The postmarks tell their story. And it's just a part of a letter that should be kept.
I love the fact that you called, Wanda. Thank you so much. Interesting, her 19-year-old granddaughter.
And I think what the granddaughter will find as the years go by is that there were really two audiences for the letters. One was her grandmother, but years from now, she'll be the audience for them. You know, she will look at those letters and be able to see herself. I mean, letters are a kind of diary if you have the chance of retrieving them at some point. And she'll have a completely different experience as a reader.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane. It's thank you for taking my phone call, and
sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
And I currently am reading that well-known book, 1776, and the author uses a lot of letters from anywhere from King George to General George Washington on down to the foot soldiers. And it really struck me as how eloquent these letters are and almost poetic. And 2 points on that. It made me wonder, did people also speak that way, or was it just in letter form? And the other thing that I wondered about is people actually saving those years for all those hundreds of years, even letters that were from the foot soldiers, who would never be, you know, famous historic people.
Well, I think, you know, they serve as voices of the forgotten. Very often, and their historical value and also their kind of memorial value. They do keep people alive. The war letters that most interested me that I wrote about in Yours Ever were Wilfred Owen's letters from the Western Front in the First World War. And Owen was highly unsuited in many ways to be a soldier, sensitive, delicate fellow. And he, along with the poems he was writing, during the war, he was sending homes back to his mother, and one of the things he says that about you, when you see how the war has hardened him, he has to perform censoring duties with the mail that gets sent home from the soldiers, and he says that when there are letters to the soldiers who have died, in other words, by the time the letter arrives,
right.
The soldier's been killed.
Yeah.
He says, "I now write deceased over the envelope without even taking the cigarette from my mouth."
Oh.
And he's such a sensitive sort of soul. And there's something harrowingly vivid about that. And, of course, that observation is one that he makes in a letter himself.
Do you think that people hearing this program might be inspired to get back to letter writing.
Well, that's a nice thought.
Isn't it, though?
I don't think the letter will disappear. And one of the things that's interesting is technology never really disappears. Radio survives, television, the internet, whatever. And I think it'll be the same for letters.
Thomas Mallon, his new book is titled Yours Ever, People and Their Letters. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Diane.
Good to have you here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.